All right, good evening. As you said to me when we walked in, welcome to Baltimore, where you can have two seasons in one day. All right? School was 2 hours late. My schedule was all messed up. Ridiculous lack of snow. All right, tonight we're going to do a very interesting topic. It's called Gender and Labor Zionism. It's really women in pre-state Israel, women in the Yishuv. But the labor ideology was the dominant one, as we know, really until 1977, when the Likud overtook the labor government in Israel. So really from its founding in the early 1900s, and certainly all through this period, and that was the one that negotiated, they were in power negotiating with the British, and then the United Nations, and what have you. So it's gender and labor Zionism. Labor Zionism in particular, you should know, bragged about its egalitarianism. Men and women were equal, were creating the new Jew in the new society. Here's a poster I found from 1934. Strong, strapping woman. You assume that she's out in the agricultural areas because of the background. It says Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, the country of our future. And that was the dominant image that they tried to project. Now, labor Zionism was very good at projecting images, even when sometimes the truth didn't meet the reality, because it was going to be a lot more difficult for women than the ideology would suggest. Of course, men didn't necessarily see it the same way. For example, in 1910, a guy named Menachem Schenken, and some of you might have been to Schenken Street in Tel Aviv, which is the kind of bohemian area with the pubs and the nightclubs, and you know, it's a pretty hip place these days. He was the director of Chovei Tzion's Jerusalem, or Israel, office. So he had this to say in 1910 when he was responding to an article in Die Zeit, the Zionist daily newspaper that Herzl had started, about what types of jobs there are for women in the land of Israel. And this is being read by all the Zionists in Europe in particular. So this is what he said, and it's kind of amazing he gets away with it, but it's that time. Occupations available in Palestine were as kindergarten teachers, seamstresses, medical assistants, midwives, masseuses, dentists, and cooks. Now, I didn't really ever think about a masseuse in the kibbutz or what have you, but apparently there was a need for it somewhere, somehow. But that was not atypical of the ideology or the sensibilities that a lot of men brought to the ideology that was supposed to say something else.
Seuss probably worked in the Schwitz.
They were Russian, after all, right? They were all Russian, and I worked at the JCC this morning, and, you know, I kind of understand it. I am going to have to learn Russian if I'm going to get my way around there. I don't know if any of you have been to the JCC early in the morning, but it's Russian in the in and out of the Schwitz. It's interesting. Anyway, there were people, like, remember our friend Joseph Klausner, the historian. In 1911, during a visit to Palestine, Klausner, who, remember, never lived in Israel, he just visited and edited Die Zeit for a few years around this time. In 1911, he said, "Most of the women have not learned Hebrew, and they are the ones unable to bear the tribulations of the land of Israel. Since they have not been infused with the love of the land, it is they who typically cause many families to leave the country." Now, I don't bring this up to anger anybody, but just to tell you that this is what a lot of the men who were the muckety-mucks in the Zionist movement actually thought, and unlike in our day today, they weren't afraid to say it. You know, you can think something today, but you don't say it. You're smart enough, hopefully, to say...
Not politically correct.
Right, not politically correct. They didn't have that issue then. They said whatever they chose to say. And as we all know, they were very dominating and domineering personalities as well. So they weren't shy about their opinions.
That was probably true, though. I mean, it was very tough for the women there, particularly, mm-hmm. to raise children.
Extremely. And you read, we'll get to it in a little bit, but some of the stories, this is a very revealing book.
That's the part that I focused on.
Yeah.
The raising the children.
Yeah. It's,
I mean, one woman's running around, she thinks her child's dead, she gives it to a stranger to ride on a horse to take it to some village, and she may or may not know where it is. I mean, it's...
And these are all real stories. This is incredible to read this now. And this was these were written in 1932, and they're talking about stories that happened in the 1910s.
Right.
So it's really, yeah.
What percentage of single women do you know?
I don't know the percentage of single women, but in the early Aliyot, really through the fourth Aliyah, it was you know, it started with 75-80% men, and then by the fourth Aliyah, it was probably down to 60-65% men. But young men, and a lot of them being single, families started coming. They didn't start coming the fourth Aliyah. They came in the first Aliyah, too. But the ones who became the leaders of the labor Zionists were almost all singles in their late teens or early 20s. The vast majority of them were men. Women, as we see, started coming on their own, particularly with the second Aliyah in 1904. But I don't know the statistics.
But this isn't much different from the development of the West in the U.S.
Right.
Yeah. There's
exactly.
Right. Yeah. Right. Although the difference comes...
Well, what the women came for in the West of the U.S.
Right. There is a big difference in some of the ones who come, and we see them, and we're going to meet Manya Shochat tonight. Some of them come as revolutionaries, anarchists, socialists, communists, Marxists, whatever the label might be, and so they're very used to being independent. And you had more of that coming from Europe than you had in this country. You had some of that in this country, but not as much. There were mainly families coming here. What you had here a lot of, even more so than you had in the land of Israel, was the men coming, my great-grandfather, for a year or two, and then sending back for the family, and bringing them from Europe to reunite them. So they were already coming as families to this country. Although some came as singles, but percentage-wise, not nearly as much. You had to be a pretty adventurous person to go to Palestine, right? You had to really... buy the ideology and be kind of fearless and not afraid of life on the edge and certainly the unknown. And keep in mind, many of them went back. That's really an unchronicled part of history. Now, it becomes an unchronicled part of history because we lose many of them after the 1917 Soviet Revolution, or the Bolshevik Revolution. All right, women had their differences too, right? Not every woman thought that all the women who are in the land of Israel should be equal to men in every single way. And in fact, this difference was accentuated when you talked about the diaspora women who wanted to support the women in the land of Israel. So listen to this. In 1919, Vera Weitzman, Chaim Weitzman's wife, we know she wrote an autobiography, had this to say about her first visit to Palestine when she came back. And she was one of the people who the next year would start the Women's Zionist Organization, which was based in Great Britain originally, she and a couple others. We were very impressed by the hard work done in rebuilding Palestine, by the devoted chalutzot, chalutz is a pioneer, chalutzot is the feminine, but we thought these enthusiastic, idealistic women were mortgaging their future motherhood and even risking their health for this principle of equality. They were working 10 or 12 hours a day, breaking rocks and stones for road making, remember Gidud HaAvodah, and mending, carrying heavy loads, performing superhuman tasks. That just wasn't natural for Vera Weitzman. And of course not, she was a high society woman, or the equivalent of it, in Great Britain. So really what you have is the ideology is less like that poster and more like this. And this is, let me get the Rise Up and Inherit the Land, 1921. It's a man. It's kind of hard to make out, but there's a mother with a woman with a child in her arms here. There's the men workers. This was kind of the more traditional appeal to the manliness of what they were trying to do. It's rooted in tradition, but it's going to be something new. And let me see. I think those quotes I just read. We have Klausner. And here's Vera Weitzman on her... That's not her first trip to Israel. That's later. And we're going to get to good old Golda Meyerson in a little bit, too. When you think about it, none of this is necessarily a surprise. The Zionist movement was founded by men, European men, from an upper-middle-class background, some of them an upper-class background, intellectual. They were creatures of their time. They weren't very visionary when it came to egalitarianism, even though they thought they were. And maybe I should say, in their time they were visionary, but they really weren't that visionary in a lot of regards. Remember Herzl's Alte Neue Land. We have females purposely taking a second role. You know, forget about the Reshet Bey, the Arab, his wife who stays at home. We have the young woman who eventually the doctor falls in love with. She's very quiet. She's always by his side. She doesn't really step out of line. The mother of the whole clan is also very non-assuming. She's very quiet. There are no dominant female figures. And it's interesting, in almost all Zionist literature that I know of, there are no dominant female figures. We had earlier on in the late 19th century, we had some romance novels being written. They were placed in the land of Israel, although in Bible times, it certainly didn't have women as a dominant figure. Well, I shouldn't even say a dominant figure, I should say an equal figure. Everybody was in a traditional role, and that's how it was seen, even though they knew that what they were doing was revolutionary. We remember our friend Max Nordau. What did he call for? Muscle Jews. Now, muscle Jews are not necessarily women, right? I mean,
But that picture showed the female version of a muscle man.
Right, right. But we don't think of it. When you talk about a muscle Jew, you don't think of a female. At least I don't, and maybe that's my own gender bias. That's possible. Anything's possible. All right. We talked a few moments ago. The first four Aliyot always had more males. The Aliyot started in 1881, remember 1904, then 1919 or 1920, and then 1923-24 as well. Things started to change, really, in the 20s, when we had some women coming out of Soviet Russia that were demanding egalitarianism. That's when things started to change. You had some in the earlier Aliyot, particularly the second Aliyah, but not that many. Not that many, but they made exceptional differences as well. The reality was, life in the settlements in particular was harsh. And because it was harsh, women had to do what men did. They eventually had to. You get into some of that in here, it becomes different when the women have children. The women are clearly pushed into traditional roles when children come along. And there were some heartbreaking stories in here. We were just talking about the woman who sent her child away, living or not, we don't know. Women are hacking away in the fields. They're helping pave roads. They want equality. Some of them wind up going back to the cities. Some of them are going to found businesses. Not many of them, but they're going to demand to have their voice heard. Things were better on the Moshav. Because anybody remember the difference between a Moshav and a kibbutz?
The Moshav, you have your own ownership.
You buy the equipment together. So you might, and the fields are divided up evenly. It's more of a private village where you do things collectively. But and a kibbutz, everything's owned by everybody. And you know, if somebody sent you $100 from abroad, it goes into the communal pot. It worked better on the Moshav because women could be more individuals there. Individualism was looked down on the kibbutz, and to an extent, it still is. Right? You were a chaver. You were a member. You were. You know, you would be addressed as such, Chaver so-and-so, Chaver Mitchell, or something like that. Or what's your Hebrew name?
Moshe.
That works better, Chaver Moshe. Definitely works better. Golda Meir in the 1920s wrote this, and I found this striking. We had a conversation last week, remember, about how she wasn't really the prototype woman in some regards. And we're going to find out that for several years, she was very active with the women's group. That's how she got her start in politics. She wrote an essay in this book, The Plow Woman, "The mother also suffers in the very work she has taken up. Always she has the feeling that her work is not as productive as that of a man, or even of an unmarried woman. The children, too, always demand her, in health and even more in sickness. And this eternal division, this double pool, this alternating feeling of unfulfilled duty today toward her family, the next day toward her work, this is the burden of the working mother." So she's writing this at a time when she's heading a woman's organization, which is kind of interesting. But she is in touch with something very important, I think. And there are some echoes in what some people have to deal with today that she's got here. It's not unusual. And she's an ideologue. But I love this picture of her. And this is in Kibbutz Merchava and 1919-1920 when she made Aliyah. She didn't look too good there. A face only a mother could love. Alright, so we remember, by the way, in the first Aliyah that many of the families that came were traditional Orthodox Jews. Some of the early stories that we read were about them making having challahs for Shabbat and getting things ready. There were some of the socialists who came in the Bilui group as well, and some in the Chovei Tzion, but a lot of them were very traditional oriented, and it was only about 50,000 total. changes started, I said, in the fourth Aliyah, but you see the seeds of it in the second Aliyah. And the reason you do is because of the ideology that these people came with. And remember, the ones who stuck out the second Aliyah, they're the ones who became the leaders. Because there were so few people who stuck it out and really had the determination to stay with their vision that they almost seemed to all be involved in the founding of something important, whether it was an organization or a place to live, a kibbutz or a moshav. They saw what they were doing as a path to self-actualization. Remember, they drank in Ber Baruchov, the Marxism of Ber Baruchov, and this was a way of perfecting the human being. They drank in the socialism of the era. Many, like a woman named Shuni Flaum, was from Germany. They saw three goals, and this was shared by many: economic independence, educating the younger generation, and helping build the land. So there was always a collective aspect too, and that's interesting. In one regard, women's rights don't get the emphasis that they have initially in Western countries and elsewhere, because remember, the suffragette movement is huge in this country in the 1910s. It's not until 1919 till women get the right to vote, but there's an overriding goal of creating the Jewish state. You know, we'll get to everything after that. So to an extent, by the way, it's the same thing that pushes almost everything else to the second burner in Israel today. What's the overriding goal in Israel today? Self-defense.
Right, survival of the
state. Survival of the state, yeah. Self-defense. Right? So things like religious pluralism get pushed down, and sometimes human rights gets pushed down, because things overwhelm that. There's a core need that must be met, or none of it really matters. And that balancing act is very difficult. Sarah Azariyahu, she was a founder of a group we're going to talk about in a moment called the Union of Hebrew Women for Equal Rights in Eretz Yisrael. And let's see, I think we have her quote over here. There we go. Whoops. She went to a little too far. We, the women of the latest wave of immigration, which has been going on, this is 1919, for more than 30 years since the Bilu group, did not come here as gentle creatures, but as women of the nation who desire to fulfill the national duty that fate has imposed upon this generation. So, 1919, we're now in the beginning of the third Aliyah. This is really still the people who were settled came in the second Aliyah. We're starting to see this issue come about. And this is also because who's controlling the country at this point?
The British.
The British. And the British are putting some normalcy into what's going on, and you can start focusing on other issues as well. So that's a quick introduction to what I wanted to do tonight. What I wanted to do for a few minutes now, before we get back to what we're doing, is talking about the Plowwoman. Not everybody obviously got to read it, and I confess I didn't read every single word of it, but I certainly skimmed it, and I read a good 75% or so. Can I get some reactions on what these stories made you think of or think about, or what stood out?
That the issues are so similar to everything women are saying today.
Give me an example.
Well, in the area of child care, which is what I read most about, and the relelinquishing of your child to the kibbutz,
what we call the nanny.
Yeah. Well, but worse than a nanny, because it wasn't individualized. There was that push-pull of, will my child get the nurturing my child needs to grow into a well-developed person, or will the structure of this form of child care stunt my child's growth? And there's real conflict about that, because
right.
Depending on where they were, how much they could interact with their child was limited, and the idea of sending a child back to sleep in a group situation with some attendant who has to be awake at night to watch all these children. So the stress on the women mm-hmm. who were assigned this job was a terrible burden.
Right. Well, that, and I think the mothers probably had some guilt also.
Well, of course. I mean, that was it. They were fearful of what were they creating in this generation.
Right. Look, I remember my wife's guilt when we sent our kids to daycare. You know?
There was a good article where the mother had guilt because she missed out on all the little things that the child did. First time they spoke, first time they walked, all these
natural milestones.
Right.
That make you feel.
So that the, quote, nanny or whoever was running the
daycare or the child care.
She saw it, but she probably didn't experience it the way a true mother would have.
Interesting.
I found something interesting where they were breastfeeding and they were even sharing breastfeeding.
Right. I read that.
I was like,
yeah. Well, I mean, they're trying to create a new society and they're trying to do something new here. Would you want your kids to be guinea pigs if this is something new? That's the question. And some of these people said, yeah, that didn't mean they didn't have guilt.
But there's some articles that basically condemned it. I thought, I read that whole section on child care.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, they're going to be real proponents of this, but it looked like they sort of pooh-poohed it.
But they were torn because of the way they had been brought up, and they were being asked to relinquish all the things that they thought were hallmarks of parenthood.
Yeah, I was very impressed by the honesty of these women. I mean, it wasn't like they drank the Kool-Aid. They were really talking about emotions. And I was really surprised that they let some of this be published. I'm thrilled that they did. It's very real. Jill, you had something?
Well, in the beginning, a lot of the stories, I found it fascinating. These women, the single ones who came over, they were clearly unprepared to do manual hard labor. They ended up in these, what were they called?
Chalutziot farms?
Uh-huh. And, you know, just doing anything. Then they were starving. There was no food to eat.
Right.
And I thought the stories of when the Bedouins were attacking and that was really fascinating, how the women really just took over and hid the weapons and get, you know, snuck food and things into the men and smuggled things out of the jail. And you just don't, I didn't know that the women had such roles like that. And the fact that they just came by themselves, were literally starving to death, were willing to do any work, and that there was one story of a woman who befriended an older man, and she couldn't get work anywhere, and he ended up at night teaching her how to graft trees.
That was Olive Dog Gordon, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was Rachel, the poet, I think.
That's Rachel?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, because and then he advised her to go to France, actually. We're going to talk about her tonight and her poetry.
I thought that was such a great story, because here she learned in like an hour how to graft a great poetry, which I actually did on a kibbutz for a couple of weeks when I was in high school, and it was pretty interesting. We changed red grapefruit to white grapefruit.
That's cool.
It's really kind of an interesting job.
Yeah.
You had to get up early to do it.
I did not expect this book to be as good as it was.
But the story is really fascinating, because it really showed you, and the whole swamp draining and the malaria.
Right.
I didn't know about the malaria, but it obviously makes sense. That
in the valley, in the Emma.
The swamp, there's going to be a lot of malaria.
Right.
Yellow fever.
And anything else stand out from anybody?
Women were paid less than men.
Absolutely. I actually read a long academic study on that.
And particularly in the cities.
Yes.
They were grossly underpaid.
Yes. And this was all approved, by the way. Wages are set by histadrut. Right? And this is approved by histadrut. So these are the guys that go back to that original poster I showed you. Women were paid less than men. You know? So to an extent, by the way, it was better for them on the farms. Because there, everybody was equal, right? You wouldn't be getting a lesser portion of food or anything like that. But you're absolutely right.
You would think, how many years, 70 years later?
Same thing
here in this country.
Yes, but you can't say the things aren't better, right? It's not where we want it to be. But, you know, for example, I have a cousin who's an attorney, you know, unheard of 70, 80 years ago. She, you know, is a woman. You know, she works for the government, and the government, they pay you the same. You know, it's just how long you've been there, ostensibly, and the pay grade you start at.
I don't want to go off on a tangent, but you have to really dive into that number to truly understand what it means, and the disparity is probably not as great as it's made out to be in the newspapers.
You mean today?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, then it was definitely a different number.
Yeah.
And you'd have to look at this specific situation. Anything else that stood out to anyone else? You know, and I loved everything about it. I loved the pictures.
Yeah, I loved it.
You know, I mean, they really did a great job. And this is a reissuing. First it was came out in 1932. Then it came out, it was either 71 or 72.
One of the first editions.
Yeah, that must be really... Well, they have a picture of the 72.
I'd like to see it.
Yeah, and then it came out again, what's this, 2010, I think? You know, I was just really, I'm really pleased to have this on my bookshelf now. I really did not think it would be as good as it was. And again, the candor of it, the diversity of it. I actually could have used a little more explanation about the women themselves. There's a little bit in the back, but there's not that much on them.
It should have like a summary attached to each
article. Exactly. Know,
just a frame of reference.
They may not have that information.
Maybe they don't.
Some of them they do. Some.
I mean, I think when they had it, they put it in, but this is a critical edition, so I imagine that they probably...
Well, the footnotes, some of them are really good. That's why I was surprised they didn't have more.
Excellent. Yeah, I think they just don't have that much information on a lot of these women.
It's worth reading the epilogues to the editions.
Yeah, that was neat, wasn't it?
It gives you a little history
of
why they were coming.
It's a great book.
We talked about, you know, the pioneer women.
Right. Amit is Pioneer Women, I think.
Namat
is Pioneer Women?
Pretty sure.
Okay. I have that in my notes somewhere in here tonight because it was a merger of something else, like everything else. All right, so if you haven't had a chance to read these stories, I encourage you to do so. Some of them are 3 pages long. The most one is probably 6 or 8 pages long. And it's really worth your time, and I'd say read one from each section. I think there's 5 or 6 main sections, if you want to read them. It's a good read.
I have to laugh. The picture in the...
Or the 72 edition?
It looks like a model, but you look at the picture of the women here, they're all pretty rugged looking.
Yeah, rugged and ragged.
Barbie doll, big propaganda.
Yeah, rugged and ragged. You know, it was a tough life, and, you know, while some of them had regrets about certain things, nobody came out and said, I shouldn't have come here, it was a mistake. You know, they said it's a tough life, basically, but, you know, we're here living the life that we're supposed to live.
The
sense was the message.
A woman who committed suicide,
you know,
at the age of 19.
It's interesting you say that. I haven't specifically been doing research, but I've been coming across a lot of stories of the era where suicide is mentioned. I know that was not an uncommon phenomenon in Germany in this era. I did study that at one point. But, you know, for example, Manya Shochat, who we're going to read about tonight, one of her sisters committed suicide in Tel Aviv. And I'm sure someone out there has done a thesis on suicide in pre-state Israel. And I wouldn't be surprised if it were higher than in other European countries, just because of the ruggedness and, you know, people get disillusioned, they're strong with their ideology.
Lonely,
no family. Yeah, I mean,
I think she was somewhat physically ill, unable to work.
Was this one of the ones in the back?
Yes.
Yeah, because they talk about people who have passed away in the back.
Shoshana,
and there's a thing on Rachel in there too, Jill, in the back. Shoshana what?
Shoshana Bogan.
Okay, I didn't read that one.
Maybe they went to Eretz Israel with depression already.
Absolutely.
I mean, they didn't go like healthy people.
Or you look at all the 19th century Dickensian stuff when women would go die of melancholy. Well, probably half of those were suicide.
Right. You know, right. Yeah, unfortunately, it's something that was more common than I thought it would be in terms of the literature. And, you know, I was reading various biographies of these women, the profile, that Jewish Women's Archive website is just terrific. I mean, just terrific, you know, the depth of it. It was one of the main sources I used. And, you know, this one's sister committed suicide, this one's brother committed suicide. You know, Herzl had one of his kids committed suicide. And the other two died relatively young as well. So it wasn't uncommon in that era. All right, back on track.
Those characters contemplate that in Alta Newland.
Yes,
hero.
That is correct. And I attribute that.
Aimless, he doesn't know what he's going to be able to achieve.
That's right, and he comes pretty close, right? He's talking about, you know, this is going to be it.
Right.
That's what's his name, the main character? It's Dr. Somebody. I just can't remember it.
Yeah,
the doctor. Anyway, let's talk about organizational skills. The Jews were great at organizing. And indeed, various white paper commissions of the British were going to note in the years to come, the Jews have done an outstanding job in creating all the trappings of a country, a nation, something that can go forward. Let's talk about the women's organizations that came up. The first one was called the Hebrew Women's Organization, or HWO. And there's a little backstory to it. This, of course, starts when all, as all things really start happening, when the British take over the country. First in 1917, they take up to Jerusalem. Then the next year, they take the Galilee and the rest of the country. There were, about that time, springing up 7 or 8 Hebrew women's associations. They weren't connected. They were in Haifa, they were in Tel Aviv, they were in Jaffa, they were in Jerusalem, they were in Beersheba, all the towns that you think they would be in, Tiberias, something like that. So they were independent first, but they all had the same goal, which was to bring together the various ethnic communities of Jews in their community under a Zionist banner. Now, this wasn't so easy because not everybody was Zionist. We know half the Jewish community, really until this point it starts to change quickly, is not Zionist. They're ultra-Orthodox. They're what are known as Mizrahi, or the Eastern Jews. There are people who are just there. The Zionist ones, by the way, are the Yemenites, who about 10,000 of them have come in from about 1904 through about 1919-1920. A woman named Batsheva Kesselman gets them together, gets these groups together. She is a Russian who moved to America around 1910 and was Zionist-oriented, and with her husband moved to Israel in 1919. So she's a Russian-American Palestinian, I guess. She put together a large assembly, a public assembly of Jewish women in Jerusalem in 1920. The leaders of Histadrut and other groups told her it wasn't necessary. All right, she did it anyway, but she was getting some pressure from these groups. They didn't want this independence. They had everything under control. She was going to become the leader of the movement, but realized that there was a much better candidate out there, the woman named Henrietta Tsold, who had just made Aliyah. So she asked Henrietta Tsold to run that organization, and Tsold, to her pleasant surprise, said, yes, I will do that. Guess which American organization supported their work? Hadassah. And how do you support the work of someone in Israel? You send money. Absolutely correct. This was Palestine's first nationwide social service organization, the Hebrew Women's Organization. I mean, no one had been focusing on this nationwide. There had been workshops. There had been a lace-making workshop by a modern Orthodox woman to try and train other modern Orthodox women to have a livelihood by creating lace. There had all been types of individual efforts. There was an effort at a hospital in Jerusalem since 1902, but this was the first nationwide social service organization, and no one better other than Henrietta Tsold, who we're going to meet a few moments down the road, to put the cart on the wheels of the organization. Because Henrietta Tsold, by the way, it's fascinating. She didn't always come up with original ideas, but boy, could she deliver on those ideas. She just knew how to make things happen. She was really unmatched. Their work around the country included supervision of pregnant women, which meant getting them nurse care and taking to doctors and what have you, sewing workshops, evening classes, legal aid, nutrition for kindergartners, milk for babies, and more. It was a Jewish family services type of operation. Right? That's, you know, whatever the woman needs, that's what we're going to be able to help with. There was an organization that was starting to form now as well. It translates to mean the Constituent Assembly, is the Nivcheret Asafim. The British periodically kept trying to get together both the Jewish and the Arab communities to have an organized group that would represent them to the British government. The Arabs never got it together, but they did at one point, but then it had to be disbanded because there were too many terrorists in it. There was the Pan-Arab Higher Committee. But the Jews had this thing called the Nivcheret Asafim, the Constituent Assembly. And at the third elections for the Constituent Assembly in the early 1920s, the Hebrew Women's Organization said, we're going to put up a slate of officers, and we're going to run to be represented in the Histadrut, which is going to be represented in the Nivcheret Asafim. And what we're going to do is we're going to say, our only demand is that you create a Department of Social Work on the National Committee. And we're going to basically run that Department of Social Work. Well, they ran for that, And they won. And guess who was chosen to head the Department of Social Work for the National Committee?
Henrietta Tsold.
So Henrietta Tsold became one of the three most, very quickly, she made Aliyah in 1920. Although she'd been going back and forth since her first visit in, it was 1902. She became very quickly one of the three most influential people in the Yishuv. She was up there with Ben Gurion. She ran the social service apparatus of the Jewish Agency. There were a lot of overlapping organizations with slightly different mandates. Again, there was organization after organization, it seemed like. In 1926, the Hebrew Women's Organization started publishing a magazine or a publication called Ha'isha, the Woman. This became the first woman's publication in the country. This is not to be confused with La'isha, for the woman, which is a current women's magazine in Israel, which is more like Cosmopolitan than what we call Practical Matters, for lack of better terminology. What Ha'isha dealt with was what were called practical questions about the women's right to vote. You know, you could write in, I'm a woman, I'm having this issue. Kind of not uncommon to the Yiddish newspapers that were in this country. If you ever, the foreword, Der Bintel Brief, which is, there's a book about Der Bintel Brief of all the, you know, letters, the best of, which is absolutely wonderful. This group, interestingly enough, the Hebrew Women's Organization, had modern Orthodox women as well as secular women. So it was a meeting ground. And that was going to be very, very important. Now, the group was also having trouble competing in Europe with WIZO, the Women's International Zionist Organization, for fundraising. Remember, this is a time, the late 20s, where Europe is still the breadbasket of the Jewish community. There's some 3 million Jews in Poland. The Jews in the Soviet Union are cut off, unfortunately, at this point. But there's hundreds of thousands of Jews in Hungary and Romania and what have you. And these guys wanted to gain support from Europe, because Hadassah had already dominated the market in the United States of America. So after 7 long years of negotiations, and one description I read said that 7 years of long and fascinating negotiations, I'm thinking, there's no way that could have been fascinating. Because they had about 6 groups negotiating. Yeah, exactly. You know, having, you know, followed some Jewish organizational negotiations, I don't think so. In 1933, they finally merged with WIZO. So it became the Israeli chapter of WIZO, the Hebrew Women's Organization. But this was, again, the first all-women's organization. Now, all these groups had slightly different agendas, as I had said, but they all had one thing that they shared in common. They wanted the right to vote. Remember, in 1919, it happens in the United States. That's a major precedent. It's not a precedent, I can't remember the year, but it's not in Great Britain yet, and it's not in Palestine. Although, interestingly, women were involved in the Second Zionist Congress, and they had the right to vote as delegates. So since 1898, women had been voting in Zionist Congresses, so this is not unprecedented. In various councils around the country, community councils or city councils, Jaffa, Tel Aviv, women had the right to run for those, and some had been elected. Let's see, it was in Jaffa in 1918, 3 were elected in community council elections.
Oh, I'm sorry. By men, though.
Hmm?
Only by men. They were elected. Women were elected.
No, I think women could vote in community in the local elections.
In the local elections.
So it was a little backwards there, right? You could vote in local, but you couldn't vote in national.
And part of that was due to pressure from the ultra-Orthodox to keep.
There's a story we're about to get to on that. The ultra-Orthodox were not happy with this at all, and this wasn't Jerusalem. This was Jaffa, right? The ultra-Orthodox were strongest in Jerusalem, Tiberias, Sfat, and Hebron. The 4 holy cities in Judaism. But they're non-existent in Tel Aviv at this point. Even today, there's very few of them in Tel Aviv. There's modern Orthodox. All right. That brings us to, what, Jill? Share.
That's why I like Tel Aviv.
That brings us to the Union of Hebrew Women for Equal Rights in Eretz Yisrael. Now, you try and get that on a business card. Okay, so a group formed just to press the right for women to vote in the land of Israel. All right, they formed in 1919 by a woman named Fanny Metman Cohn. She was a school teacher and a principal of a Zionist school. Prior to her Aliyah in 1904, she came with her husband and son. She came from Russia. In 1906, she and her husband founded the Herzliya High School Gymnasia, the Herzliya Hebrew Gymnasium in Jaffa. So it was a secular high school in which boys and girls were taught together. And one was going to come up in Tel Aviv, and one was going to come up in Jerusalem. This was what the Zionist pioneers, the secular pioneers, really wanted. Boys and girls being raised in the same educational system. Because remember, it wasn't that way by any stretch back in Europe. All these women revolutionaries who came over, they got it on their own. You know, they almost all came from enlightened families, Haskalah families, where they were taught on the side, not in official school, not in high school, because girls didn't go to high school. All right, so this group, the Union of Hebrew Women for Equal Rights in Eretz Israel, was a response to the ultra-Orthodox and the Mizrahi blocking of the women's right to vote. Women voting, of course, was acceptable to the secular. There was going to be a split in the religious. Eventually, the modern Orthodox were going to say, okay. But not at first. They were against it because they didn't want to be seen as not religious. Right? There's always that fear, looking over your right shoulder. All right, so they want participation in the upcoming election for the body, the Nivcheret HaSafim, that's going to represent the community to the British. Excuse me, I copied my notes there. All right, here's what their issues were. Opposition to child marriage, because child marriage was still acceptable in the Haredi community and the Mizrahi community, and the British initially said, we're going to allow it because we don't want to interfere in the religious lives of the communities. So the British ducked out on religious freedom. It's an interesting clash of values. It wasn't abolished, and the Arabs too had it. It wasn't abolished until the mid-1930s. It's really amazing.
And child meaning up to what age?
Child, I assume it means up to 16, 18. Yeah. You know, when in Jewish law, boys has his bar mitzvah, he's ready to be married in traditional communities. Or you go and you live with your father-in-law. In Russia, you go and you live with your father-in-law until you're 14, 15, something like that, and you finally get married. And that's the mentality that these people had, because that was the driving ethos of their community, was, you know, what was happening in Mother Russia, or not Mother Russia for them. They wanted women's right to citizenship on immigration to the country, which women apparently didn't get right away. And they wanted the right to obtain certificates for families abroad on the basis of their own income without their husband's permission. To make Aliyah, you had to have a certificate, which was a permission slip from the mandate authorities, particularly if you were coming without financial money, without financial means, and you couldn't say, I'm going to support myself, I'm not going to be a burden on the public debt, or what have you. They want to be able to bring their family members over without their husband's permission. All right. Let's talk a little bit more about the suffragette movement, the women's right to vote movement. This issue was a thorn in the side for the Orthodox community, for certain. But Ben-Gurion and others in the Yishuv wanted unity. They wanted to be able to go to the British and say, always, on all matters, this is something that we agree on. The ultra-Orthodox weren't going to have it that way. They weren't going to have this representation of all because they didn't believe in Zionism. They hated Zionism. Even though it was already starting to bring them some benefits in terms of the building up of the country, in terms of the roads and the railroads and the water system and, you know, the medical care and what have you. So in 1925, everybody agreed in the Jewish community that there was going to be a national referendum on the right of women to vote. This is what we've all been waiting for. There are two conditions, really three. Women would be able to vote in the referendum. That makes sense, all right? The religious community was going to agree to the results. But the religious men, their vote would count twice. It would count. Why would it count twice?
The wife, too.
Because, of course, the wife would agree to what the man, you know. Of course. So
didn't we have a constitution or something? 3/5 or something?
Yeah, 3/5, right. Yeah. Right, counting slaves. Yeah. We've had some issues in this country. We've had some issues. It's not unusual. Women's groups were kind of not happy with this. In fact, they were outraged, and they urged that the vote be canceled outright. We're not even going to participate in this vote. There's no, absolutely no way. But then the ultra-Orthodox rabbis overruled their representatives to the British and said, we're not going to participate in the vote. Well, when they said we're not going to participate in the vote, then the women's group said, okay, then we're going to vote. So there's a lot of political jockeying going on here. The modern Orthodox said they will participate in the vote, splitting the Orthodox community. And this is really the beginnings, in some regards, at least in Israel itself, that already started in the Zionist Congress, of modern Orthodoxy being very Zionist-oriented. It still continues today. You know, it's a very Zionist-oriented community. In fact, you know, at one point through the 70s, even the 80s, the elite soldiers in the Israeli army, the units, the majority of them were from the kibbutz movement. Now they're from the modern Orthodox movement, and particularly from the settler movement on the West Bank. And they're very nationalist-oriented. All right, so without the ultra-Orthodox, they decided not to have a vote. Said, we can't do it. It's not representative. But then there was another vote for the Constituent Assembly in January 1926, which the Orthodox boycotted. And in this, equal rights were declared for women in social, political, and economic aspects of the issue. The very next year, they voted to agree to allow women to have the right to vote in national elections. So it wasn't an easy road. 1927, these groups formed in 1919, 1920. Took 7 or 8 years. Now, they didn't have the mass marches like we had in this country. It was a different type of issue. They worked through the various party mechanisms, but ultimately, it came to be. So women now had the right to vote. Meanwhile, over in the socialist camp in 1921, there's a group formed called the Moetzet HaPoelot. Let's see. We're going to get the Moetzet HaPoelot translates to mean the Women's Working Council. This was the woman's group of Histadruts. It formed independently, but it pretty much merged in almost all ways with Histadrut. It later became known as Na'amat, the Women's Working Council, the Moetzet HaPoelot. A key figure was a woman named Ida Maimon. She was from a modern Orthodox family. Her family back was known as the Mizrahi Party. But at the same time, she was a socialist. Right? Everybody has a crazy ideology in this place at this time. She's modern Orthodox and a socialist. I don't think you could do that today, but she found a way to make it work for her. So, remember, 1920, at the founding of Histadrut, no women were elected to the founding council. She threatened protests. And she basically said, I'm going to start a women's group, and you're going to allow it to have a voice in Histadrut. It's going to be the Women's Working Council. And they got a little scared, actually. They didn't want that splintering of the ranks. Again, it would look bad. So they agreed to allow her to do that. And of course, Histadrut was young at that point, so it didn't want the fracture anyway. So what happened was the women who joined Histadrut would automatically become members of the Moetzet HaPoelot. And you could just join Moetzet HaPoelot, and ostensibly you were part of Histadrut as well. But again, it was, in terms of the structure, it was somewhat on the outside, just slightly on the outside. The wives of Histadrut members were automatically included. There was some tension here because you had stay-at-home moms and working moms in the same organization. And it was a workers' organization, and they demanded different things from the organization. Because of that, their goals weren't published until 1931. And let's see if I have them here for us.
Right there, Goals of the World Women's Working Council?
Yeah.
1931, right there.
Yeah, good.
All right, so we will educate women workers in Eretz Yisrael in agriculture and train them to perform various urban and non-urban occupations We will establish cooperatives and workshops for women workers and will assist working mothers by creating accommodation for children. We will propagate, I love the terminology that was put in here, we'll propagate culture and educational activity among women workers. In order to achieve these goals, the Association of Women Workers is entitled to negotiate with other associations and institutions. So they declared some independence from Histadrut on purpose. They didn't want to be say, you can rein us in, we won't talk to that group, we won't talk to that group. In 1934, to further their goals, they launched a publication called Devar HaPoelet, which was inserted in the newspaper Devar. It was a monthly. You remember, Devar was the newspaper started by Beryl Katznelson back in 1925. He was the brilliant ideologue of labor Zionism. All right. I'm going to take a break right now because this is a good point to take a break before we start a new section. Any questions until now?
How many women are you talking about in Eretz Israel at that time?
Okay, so there are... Let me do the math real quickly. There's 50,000 by 1904. There's 85,000, roughly 100,000 people. So we're probably talking 30,000 women. 30,000 women. Yeah. So it's still about 70% men. But we're going to start seeing families come over. So it's going to change.
30,000. We're not talking about a couple hundred women.
No. We're talking, and you know, like everything else, the majority are in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and Tel Aviv, Jaffa, Jerusalem.